Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Okay, Stack Waddy Game, are you going first or am I?
I'll go first if you want. I've got two options. You can choose the two subjects if you want. You get a choice. I don't mind. I'm happy either way.
Go on.
One is from the dark satanic mills of black metal, and the other is footballers who've made singles.
Oh, I can't resist footballers who've made singles. So you're going to have one who didn't make a single.
Yep. Okay. All right. Here's six footballers.
Okay.
Who made a single. This is the name of their single. And you've got to identify the one that isn't real. Okay.
So these are solo singles.
Solo singles.
All right.
Okay. Yep.
Go on.
Dion Dublin had a single out called Doing the Doob. Okay. Yeah, Andy Cole had one called Outstanding. We had Ian Wright, Do the Right Thing.
Right.
Okay. Kevin Keegan, Head Over Heels in Love.
Yep.
Vinnie Brown's Big Bad Leroy Brown. Big Bad Leroy Brown. And Rude Hullett's Not the Dancing Kind.
Okay. Purely on the grounds that he's far too boring to have ever done this, I'm going to say Andy Cole never made a single.
Oh, right. Okay. No, Andy Cole amazingly did.
Oh, God.
He put a record which was fantastically unsuccessful. It was called Outstanding. Yeah. And he was briefly really hot, wasn't he, Andy Cole?
I know, exciting at all. Exciting.
No, the others did. Yeah, Kevin Keegan did. Vinnie Jones did. You remember, Rude Hullett had number 10 hit in Holland in 1984. It was astonishing. And Dion Dublin has not put out a single, but he has invented a drum called the Doom. Six-sided cuboid drum. And everyone is expecting that by now he would have got out a single.
Yeah, sure.
Something like Doing the Doom.
Yeah, it's because he's Mr. Personality, isn't he, Dion Dublin? Turn his hand to both things. We'll await the Dion Dublin debut single. Okay, over all to right. me. Over
Go
to
on.
Me.
Go on.
Legendary New York venue, CBGBs.
Yeah. Okay.
The following bands all played at CBGBs. Okay, back in the day. Okay.
Yeah.
Here we go. Gorilla Biscuits.
Okay.
The Clits. The Lunar Chicks.
Yeah.
The Laughing Dogs. And youth of today.
Oh God, that's really difficult.
Okay, five, but one of them is completely made up.
Okay, and
Gorilla
Biscuits. Back in the day, you're talking about 1975, 76. Is that right?
Well, 70s into the 80s, really. You're talking about CBGB.
Okay. Gorilla Biscuits, the Clits, the Lunar Chicks, Laughing Dogs, and Youth of Today.
Yes.
Which one? That really, really is hard. The Clits is very funny, and that's kind of, I would imagine that's real, because the sort of edgy thing that New York clubs would have done in the mid-70s. Lunar Chicks, I think, existed. Laughing Dogs, I sense, is almost too, I don't know, maybe that's just too ordinary. Could you have made that up? I'm not sure. Yeah, Youth of Today is pretty ordinary, though, isn't it? Dave, I think I'm going to go for Gorilla Biscuits. I don't really know why, but Gorilla Biscuits sounds like something that has been cooked up by D. Hepworth.
Well, you're insulting the memory of the Gorilla Biscuits, because they really did exist.
Are you kidding me?
The ones who didn't exist were the Clits.
Okay. Actually, I should have figured that out, because why would you call a group something like that? Because you'd never have gotten the radio, would you?
Well, I don't know. It sounded like the Slits, didn't it, really? But anyway, there you go.
There you have it.
Those groups have played CBGB, never had any notion of being on the radio anyway. So there we go. That's the Stack Waddy Game for this week. So what's the anniversary of Donna Summer?
Oh, Donna Summer. We're talking about Donna Summer. Love to Love You Baby came out 45 years ago. Well, a version of it was tested in the clubs, I think. The actual release, I think, was in the autumn. But I'm pretty sure it was pretty much exactly now that the first version came out. And you wrote a brilliant thing in one of your books, I think it was in Fabulous Creation, about the arrival of that record and how it happened. Giorgio Moroder, am I right?
Well, yeah, I remember. The way I remember it is I was working in HMV in Oxford Street at the time, and there used to be this guy who used to come in quite, you know, once a year maybe, and he was I think he ran a disco or a hotel or something in Beirut, I think it was, and he used to just come over and stock up on all the records to play, you know, in his club. And, you know, it would be, I don't know, Barry White or Marvin Gaye or whatever at the time. And I dealt with him, and he said to me, "Have you got any sex music?"
Was a category.
Yeah, he said it rather as if it was a category.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I rather blushed. And when I tried to get further details out of him, what he was really referring to was he'd heard a version of Love to Love You Baby by Donna Summer, because that was just utterly the hot thing. And of course, the reason he called it sex music was it was sort of like a sexual demonstration record, you know. That was the way it sounded to people at the time, because we hadn't got used to kind of wall-to-wall, you know, endless disco music, you know, where kind of the sound of the female orgasm was an absolute commonplace.
Whereas, a girl in a state of high excitement, isn't it?
Whereas in those days it wasn't. And I remember getting him this record. And then the story goes that Giorgio Moroder he knew Donna Summer. She was a session singer. She'd done all kinds of things. She came from Boston, Massachusetts, I think. And she ended up in Europe in a production of Hair and, you know, and the various things. Well, she got married to somebody in Europe, hence the name Summer. And he said to her, "If you've ever got any ideas for tunes or anything, come to me." And she went to him later, and all she had was just "Love to Love You Baby."
It was that phrase, really, wasn't it?
That's right, yeah. Just that. And so he was taken with that. And so they did some kind of very basic demo. And they took it to MIDEM, to the music, you know, the industry trade festival, and shopped it around. And one of the people who heard it was Neil Bogart. Neil Bogart, who was the leading light of Casablanca Records. Casablanca, a record label, never been accused of good taste. You know, Casablanca was the record label that brought the world Kiss. You know?
That's right.
But, you know, Neil Berger knew what sold. And he said, "It's very good, this, but it needs to be longer." And they said, "Well, how long?" He said, "Well, it needs to be long enough to soundtrack an orgy."
Soundtrack an orgy. And so, you know, so now it becomes, what is your definition of how long that should be?
I can't remember.
In terms of stamina,
14 minutes or something like that, 12 minutes. Neil Bogart said it as if he regularly had orgies round at his house. You know?
Yeah.
And, of course, the interesting thing about that record is, if you're going to listen to it, you know, it gets kind of put in with all her subsequent hit records, most of which were utterly electronic, whereas Love to Love You Baby is quite an old-fashioned sounding record.
It's got a real drummer, isn't it?
It's got a real drummer.
So that real drummer has to sustain. How long was it again? Was it 14?
Well, they 15 or something like 15 minutes. I can't remember.
Well, that's not looped, is it? That's just a sustained.
Now, I think if you go and listen to the LP, I think it fades occasionally and then comes back.
Yeah.
Which probably means that they're cross-fading two versions.
Yeah.
Because
the
drummers simply can't keep it, you know. Can't keep it up, you know. So subsequent to "Love to Love You Baby," you got, you know, "I Feel Love," which I suppose 2 years later or something like that, where it is electronic percussion, and where famously Brian Eno turned up in the studio in Berlin, where he and David Bowie were making whatever record they were making, and said, "This record
will change
the sound of pop music." And, you know, Brian Eno is well known for making sweeping statements, many of which get forgotten because they, you know, don't turn out to be true. For instance, he's been predicting the return of doo-wop for about the last 40 years. But what he said about "I Feel Love" was absolutely correct. It did absolutely
totally
changed the sound of all kinds of music, you know, years
ago. But for lots of reasons, wasn't it? Because, I mean, one, there was it's the four to the floor rhythm, isn't it?
Yeah, it's
a kind of standard 4-4 rhythm, which is different from... Well, you know,
as Simon Naviabella, I think, said that when we had Simon as one of our guests on Word in Your Ear ages ago, he said it was music for white people to dance to.
Yeah,
there's a kind of no nuance in it at all. You know,
yeah.
Any clown could dance.
Anybody can dance to Four to the Floor. Exactly
to that kind of sound.
And the other amazing thing is it's got that idea of repetition. I think you mentioned in the book that Autobahn had come out in 1974, so about a year beforehand. And Autobahn is a 22-minute kind of art piece, isn't it, about Kraftwerk's idea of just travelling on the endless, monotonous motorway. There's something mesmeric about it. But up till then, no one had thought of that idea of just repeating the same theme, had they? It had to be a song structure. You know, there had to be different shapes to the track.
I mean, the thing that people forget about or don't know about Kraftwerk and Autobahn is when it appeared, it was very popular, but it was regarded as a novelty record.
Yeah, it was.
You know, it was kind of a completely one-off.
Yeah.
You couldn't possibly do anything like that again, could you? Of course, they then did, you know.
Yeah.
It wasn't the subsequent records weren't about the Autobahn. But you never listened to a Kraftwerk record later on and thought, hang on, something will happen in a minute. No.
You know, middle eight's going to come in. The horn section's going to kick in.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. And so, yeah, Love to Love You Baby is very significant, you know,
and
gateway
another thing
record.
Is that Neil Bogart tested the record out, I think, didn't he? Didn't he have a couple of parties where he played the record?
Well,
he looked at the reaction that people went out and danced and people really responded to it. Well, I thought that's interesting because you can't really dance music from then on, really. People do tend to kind of... market research it, don't they?
They
play early tracks to see what works on the dance floor, what doesn't, and then you edit it accordingly.
Yeah, I think that's certainly true. And then you edit and you remix and you extend and you find all sorts of different ways of varying the the basic recipe. So yeah, did I tell you I went to Donna Summer's house?
No, amazing. Where was that?
She lived in, and I'm trying to work out exactly when this must have been. It has to be the early 90s or something.
Yeah.
And I was out in California doing something. And her record company in Britain, who at the time were WEA, I think, and I think she had put out records with Pete Waterman, who'd kind of, you know, brought her back, and they just wanted somebody to interview her for this kind of EPK, as they call it. You remember those electronic press kits?
Yeah.
It was a paid job, you know. And so, would you come to Donna's house? So I went to Donna's house, and Donna, someone very nice lady.
So already I have it in my mind as being something like the content of that song. You know, it's a kind of you see kind of vast waterbeds. You see your mirrors on the ceiling.
No, it wasn't like that at all. She lived out in Hidden Valley in, about 40 minutes north of LA, which is an area where I think Michael Jackson lived at one time. You know, it was kind of...
All right, yeah.
It's kind of place where huge, you know, people who made fortunes in the music business or movie business or whatever went out and bought themselves ranches and had loads of horses and lived this kind of, you know, idealized cowboy, landed gentry lifestyle.
Yeah, yeah.
And she was out there with her husband and her teenage daughters. And what her main passion was at the time was painting. I don't even remember this.
No.
And that's what she wanted to talk about. Heart sinks, pop star.
Oh, my God.
Very few things could come
up. What the record company would have wanted, would it?
I think we got a bit about music. We got a bit about painting as well. It was, she had a painting, a studio down the bottom of a garden. But anyway, she's a very nice lady. So that nothing terribly exciting occurred. But I went to Donna Summer's house.
That's a very memorable. I'm immensely impressed. I never knew that.
there's always something to learn about me.
The Word Podcast. It passes the time.
I was listening to a podcast the other day. Ricky Wilson out of the Kaiser Chiefs. He happened to be talking about cars, but anyway. And he said he wasn't sure whether he wanted to put gold and silver discs up on his wall or not. And I thought, that's an interesting thing. And my question to you, Mark Ellen, is if you, you know, somehow made hit records, would you put gold discs and silver discs on your wall? Would you do it?
I'd like to think that I wouldn't.
Good.
Don't you think? Because I think it's, well, for lots of reasons. One, it's kind of gauche, isn't it? It's gauche and it's tasteless. And two is, how awful to have to brag about that, because you're bragging about commercial success rather than the quality of your work. And thirdly, you shouldn't have to tell people what you've achieved. You know, that's the main thing. It's a bit like reviewing yourself. It's a bit like saying, you know, the quality of my records is this. It's not up to you to say that. No, it's up to other people. You can't make those assessments. Do you know what I mean?
I know what you mean. But there's also the additional factor that gold and silver discs are manufactured, you know, like there's no tomorrow. They're just turning them out absolutely all the time to mark every particular little sales record. So yeah. It's not like an Oscar or a Grammy or whatever, where there's a limited number of them, you know. So I've always found with gold discs and silver discs, whenever you go to somebody's house and they've got them there, you go and look at the little plaque underneath. And it always says something slightly disappointing, like,
yeah,
to Mark
for 100,000 sales in Belgium.
Cape, Belgium. Whatever, you know. It's never, you know, it's like you say, you know, if you've made She Loves You or you know, you've lost that loving feeling, it doesn't need, you know, a record, you know, a commemorative record on your wall to underline what you've done. It's pretty obvious to people what you've done. Now, they always look rather needy to me.
They're really desperate.
They always end up in the management office, in my experience. I don't know if I've ever seen them in a rock star home.
Or on eBay.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's possibly the case.
Because it sort of derives from what Australians used to call the brag wall, didn't they? There was Australians used to have the brag wall. I don't know if they still do, but the brag wall was a kind of your part of the living room, which announced all the things you'd achieved. So it was kind of awards, things you were proud of.
The people who are worse for doing this are footballers, of course, who, you know, every time, you know, they get a hat trick or whatever, they keep the ball. And it's put there on some kind of case in their home, you know, with the shirt that they wore on that day, and you know, they end up
with a little ticket explaining that.
Oh yeah, really?
Oh my God!
Oh God! What? I mean, the people. You can find this stuff on YouTube where people take you around their kind of their museum type annex to their massive house in North London or wherever it is. You know, where they keep all that stuff, is that they have to remind you that they were once a big noise, you know. They sort of don't have to, you know.
They shouldn't have to. It sounds insecure and it's pathetic. You know, it's embarrassing. It's embarrassing.
If you're rude hullet, you know, we know what you achieved in the game, you know what I mean? You don't need to keep on reminding us, you know. So similar, if you went around to Bob Dylan's house, do you think there would be a gold disc on the wall? I don't think so. If you go to Paul McCartney's, I think
it's extraordinary.
There might be something in a workroom somewhere on the, you know, in the farther reaches of the estate or something.
But the only gold disc I ever got was a Bob Dylan one. And in those days, if you were thought to be one of the people who contributed to the success of a record, I'm sure you've had a few as well.
No, I got one
for Oh Mercy. It was a gold disc for Oh Mercy. It was saying to thank you for the contributions or whatever it would have been. Q Magazine for the 150,000 sales of Oh Mercy by Bob Dylan. I'm really, really pleased when I got it. And I thought, what can I do with this? I mean, nothing. I'm not even the artist. I'm nothing to do with it. I just happened to be somebody who put him on the front of a magazine, as any fool would have done at the time when the record was out. But anyway,
have you still got it?
Is it now? That's a good point. It's up somewhere in the roof.
Well, I'm sorry, it's got to come down. Because
I have to go and find
I can't believe that. I never knew you had this.
No, I have. I don't think I found it.
You're going to go up there after we've done this and you're going to find that. And that's going to feature in some future word in your attic. definitely. So anyway, it's only the last week that I learned about the culture of the Stan. Do you know the Stan
culture? Yes. Yeah. Well, actually, my wife just asked me what Stan meant. And Stan is, unless I'm entirely mistaken, is a combination of stalker and fan, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, God.
It's over. Is that right? Over. Yes. Oh, possibly derived from the Eminem song Stan, actually, who has that very, very peculiar character at the end who's responsible for the death of the girlfriend. But I mean, no, Stans are kind of overzealous, maniacal fans, aren't they? Who team together in order to ensure that there is maximum and uncritical coverage of the stars that they support.
We started talking about this because there's a piece in The Guardian about the Stan response to the critical response to the Taylor Swift most recent album, which is generally speaking had immensely favourable responses. But then the odd one was, you know, withheld a little bit of praise somehow, I don't know. And of course, these Stans who back in the day used to express themselves by sending letters, please note, very often inscribed in green ink, you know, to
pressing
individuals.
Very hard. That's right.
Pressing very hard. Send it to you and me at Smash Hits or wherever because we'd been, you know, less than fulsome in our praise of I don't know who it would have been at the time.
Sham 69. receiving it was a very, very aggressive mail about a review.
But never at the time did it ever cross your mind, this person might want to do me harm, you know what I mean? Or this person might want to terrorize me or my family or somehow, you know, interfere with the normal, you know, daily life and so forth. Whereas the point
but
of
this is
The Guardian is exactly what's happening.
Yeah, because
now.
There's a girl who wrote the Pitchfork review, which I think was less than their 100%, a girl called Gillian Mapes. And they leaked a load of her contact information. They put up a picture of her home. Can you imagine? Kitty Empire writes for The Observer, wrote a review, and they said something like, they warned her beforehand, 100%, 100 out of 100, or some shit will leak. We're going to find your address. Watch out for your windows. You're thinking, this is insane. So you're running the risk, supposedly, if you write something that's other than a 100% enthusiastic review of one of these people's albums, of people supposedly coming around and lobbing up half brick through your living room. I mean, that's not good, is it?
I mean,
wouldn't you be kind of slightly cautious about taking on the commission?
I would.
I really would. I think it's just not worth it.
You see, because that's the thing nowadays, is what are people frightened of most? They're frightened of the public. They're frightened of the mob coming up the drive with flaming torches.
They are.
And this is another example of it, you know. I may only appear to be me in my bedroom in Stoke Poges, you know, tapping away. But actually, we are legion. There are millions of us out here, and we are watching you. You know, and it's not hard to be intimidated by that kind of thing. And the natural outcome of this, all this stuff, is people just stop broadcasting their opinions about stuff like that because it's simply not worth the trouble. You know, I think
it's not worth the trouble because it's the point that volunteering any opinion at all publicly now in that kind of forum is going to upset somebody somewhere who doesn't agree with you, and they're going to take such a polarized and vicious view of your standpoint that it's just going to make life very, very difficult.
So one of these people undoubtedly at some point, it hasn't happened yet, I don't think, but at some point it will end up in court. One of these cases will end up in court because somebody will just go that bit too far and you'll end up, you know, people giving evidence in front of a judge saying, and why did you give this record only 9.5 out of 10? You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's right. That's well, Malud, you know, I thought the guitar solos were too long and drum sound wasn't high enough in the mix. God, that's appalling.
So while we're on the subject of the world going to hell in a handcart, Danny Baker sent me this thing yesterday about the somebody's been coming up with some kind of Bowdlerized lyrics for Robbie Robertson's The Night They Drove Old.
Oh, yeah, I saw that. Yeah.
You know, which supposedly glorifies the old South and so forth. And so some clown has, I can't believe that anybody could do this, has written an extra verse that sort of says, you know, I'm not like my father, all this kind of thing. I'm totally...
Oh, I looked it up. This is a guy called...
I've forgotten his name.
Early James?
Yeah.
Because the original lyric, I think, is, like my father before me, I'm a working man. And like my brother before me, I took a rebel stand. Well, he was just 18, proud and brave, but a Yankee laid him in his grave. And this guy changed it to, unlike my father before me, who I will never understand. Unlike the others below me who took a rebel stand, depraved and powered to enslave, I think it's time we laid hate in its grave. I mean, this is very, very extraordinary. Don't you think it's an extraordinary story?
Well, look, you know, people have always, you know, oh, God, where do you begin with this? You begin with the word problematic. When people talk about things, they're problematic, they're troublesome. You know, I think if you find yourself talking about art in terms of what's problematic and what's troublesome, you ought to just find something else to do, you know, because, you know, loads of art is problematic and troublesome. It always has been and it always will be, you know. And how are you going to solve it? Are you going to do like that? In the 18th century, they rewrote Shakespeare's plays, giving them all happy endings, didn't they? Because they thought that was the way to deal with it.
Yeah.
And that, you know, this is an example of the same kind of thing. You know, if you don't want to sing The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down, I've got a really novel idea for you. Don't sing it. Okay, just don't sing it.
Ignore
you don't
it.
Have to. Just totally ignore it. If it's that much of a problem for you, just leave it alone. Don't, whatever you do, sit there with your pencil and paper and say, I'm going to insert a bloody verse in the middle of this thing, which apart from anything else will be, you know, distinctly the clankiest bit of writing in the entire song because it's been added by you, you clown, and then you're going to sing it.
It is metrically slightly uneven, isn't it?
It's just terrible.
And I mean, I can understand people being alive to the fact that, you know, it's a song about the...
Of course it is. That's always been there.
You know, but I mean, Robbie Robertson's given some interviews recently and, you know, the point he makes is, you know, and is that it's just a story about a Southern family. I don't think anywhere in the song is there any kind of judgment about the values or that. It's a portrait of a Southern family. Yeah. And you know, these are the kind of these are the poor Southerners who were who are conscripted to be in this war.
Well, he doesn't even have to go. You know, you shouldn't have to. It's a piece of art. For God's sake, it stands on its own.
It does.
It's an absolute masterpiece.
Yeah,
he doesn't need Robbie Robertson or anybody else going out and apologising for any bit of it or saying, oh, you may have misread this bit or that. You know. It's up to you as an individual to deal with that stuff. You know, America...
Exactly. We all know what the context of it is and we all make our own judgments about it.
Yeah, well, you know, there's tons of American literature and theatre and whatever that's imbued with the story of this, you know, terrible, you know, civil war and everything that's implied by it. But you don't make it better by suddenly standing to one side and going, in case anybody's upset by this verse, let me explain what it meant.
Yeah.
It really makes me bloody livid, actually. You know.
Well, liberty.
Well, you know.
No, absolutely fair to make a comment about it. That's totally understandable. But to get in there and kind of improve it, is right. Make it contemporary. Now it's okay. Because I've got it there. Be like taking a palette of paints and rearranging a quarter of a famous masterpiece with it.
Yeah, and it's just have a bit of damn respect for the thing. Or, as I said, leave it alone.
Don't get involved.
Nobody's making you do it at all, you know. Exactly. Nobody's forcing this on you. Whereas now I know that guy's done that and I've read that verse, it's going to be in the back of my mind every time I hear that song. You know,
how dare he
trample on my relationship with The Night That Drove Old Dixie Down by, you know, putting in these stupid ideas. So anyway, that's him dealt with. He'll never work again.
This is a junction in the Word podcast. It separates that bit from this next bit.
So, yes, Wayne Fontana, he of the Mindbenders, died very sadly recently. The Game of Love singer, as I think he'd probably be described. And it's kind of interesting for lots of reasons, I think. One is that, you know, like all these groups, everybody is subject to the threat of shifting fashion. And the success of the Beatles particularly, and then groups generally, meant that any group that had a singer with a band, Wayne Fontana and the Mindbenders, Brian Poole and the Tremolos, somehow managed to kind of shed the singer and carry on just as the group.
It's weird.
I know. And both in those cases, both had lots of success. Yeah. I mean, Eric Stewart was the later of 10cc, became the singer of the Mindbenders, and they had a big hit with whatever it would have been, Groovy Kind of Love.
Groovy Kind of Love, yeah.
Oh, yeah. And the Trems did
really well. Tremolos really big for a few years.
Yeah. But the other interesting thing, I think, is that before, you know, again, around the time of the Beatles, the British pop industry was in awe of America. They were romanticising about American films and American culture. It all seemed so desirable. And that obviously changed with the British invasion. But in that early stage, before the big success of the Beatles and Dave Clark, Firebird, Stones, all that in America, people changed their name. British groups changed their names, often with a kind of American tinge to it, didn't they?
Definitely. Now, I've written about this in my upcoming book, which I'm going to plug unashamedly.
Quite rightly, yeah.
It's called Overpaid, Oversexed, and Over There, which is about British bands in America. And it really struck me when I looked at this, that it was like back in the day, if you wanted to be a conjurer or a magician, you had to be called the Great Marvo or something like that.
That's right.
They had to have that kind of name.
Yeah. But
something similar happened with the naming of pop stars, that you couldn't be a pop star if you were still called, as Wayne Fontana was, Glyn Ellis. You simply couldn't be a pop star called Glyn Ellis. And so all those people, you know...
Ron Witchley was Billy Fury.
Billy Fury.
Reg Smith was Marty Wilde.
Yes. David Grundy became Dave Berry, you know.
Yeah.
So they all changed to names that had some kind of association. Wayne Fontana was... the name was pinched from DJ Fontana, who was the drummer on Elvis Presley. Elvis Presley Records. And you simply had to do that because it really struck me that the original names that these had were all like kind of grocery boys' names, you know what I mean? They were all kind of parochial. They all kind of, you know, redolent of cobbled streets and bicycles, you know, delivering the groceries.
That's right. Like
taking
that's
stuff
right.
for the butcher, you know?
Yeah.
Those kind of things, you know. One of my favorites, not so much a lead singer, but the drummer of the Searchers, was his real name was Chris Crummy, Christopher Crummy.
That's great.
And you simply cannot be in a band in 1962 or 64 or whatever while called Christopher Crummy. And so he changed it to Chris Curtis, you know.
Well, Freddie Garrity of Freddie and the Dreamers. Well, he just dropped the Garrity. So like, you never knew. And Jerry Marsden, you know, not that there was anything wrong with Marsden, but I mean, he was just known as Jerry. And rather than change his name, he just get rid of the name that looked a bit lumpen and clumsy, you know.
It was to do with the kind of the British cringe over anything that seemed British at the time, you know.
It did.
It changed over a long period of time. Because don't forget, you know, even the Beatles early days, you know, Paul called himself Paul Ramon.
Paul Ramon.
At one
Paul Ramon. Why the Ramones are called the Ramones, in fact.
Yeah.
That's right, yeah.
And of course, Richard Starkey did obviously, you know, present himself as a Ringo Starr, which is like a character out of a Western.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you had to do those things to your name to affect the transformation from you, your normal kind of embarrassed, you know, inhibited self in the living in a London suburb or wherever you were.
Yeah, exactly.
Into this larger-than-life creature who had this fabulous name like Wayne Fontaine.
Which is a truly great name. And you think about it, it's a brilliant name. Wayne Fontaine of the Mind Reader is fantastic. And there were so many others, like Paul Pond, Paul Jones. They had those kind of... Paul Jones has a wonderful American War of Independence record.
Well, it did. Absolutely.
It,
John Paul Jones, you know. That
John Paul Jones, the naval commander in the
Revolution. Whereas if you said, now, ladies and gentlemen, our lead singer, Paul Pond.
Paul Pond. you finish your pint and go home.
Look, there's no magic about that at all, you know. I mean,
others that you mentioned in the upcoming book, which I love, which is the Nashville Teens. If you get the Nashville Teens, we're from Woking.
Yes.
They're a British group.
Nothing Nashville about them at all.
The Stormsville Shakers were from Guildford.
Yeah.
I mean, that's fantastic, isn't it?
There's no such place as Stormsville, but it sounds as though it was some place in the United States where absolutely everything was happening.
Well, there was a wonderful kind of counter reaction to this in America later on after the British invasion, where lots of American stars were trying to kind of anglicise their names, weren't they, and make them sound kind of almost aristocratic. So you've got the Amboy Dukes.
Yeah,
you've got the Charlatans, you've got the Sir Douglas Quintet.
The Sir Douglas Quintet.
That's a brilliant.
I mean, how weird is that as a name? You know what I mean?
I know.
Sir Douglas.
Yeah.
And then Quintet.
Yeah.
And they came from Texas. You know?
That's right.
And there was kind of no change in the music they played or anything at all, but they just dressed as if they were a British group. But yeah, there are a whole load of those bands.
There was a great... Do you remember the Dukes of Stratosphere records that came out, that Andy, that XTC put out? And they had these wonderful sort of stage names, you know. And Andy Partridge called himself Sir John Johns, which is keying into that perfectly, isn't it? And Dave Gregory was Lord Cornelius Plum. I mean, that's fantastic. It's a fantastic send-up of what Americans would have called themselves.
Yeah.
To try and sound, posh and British.
Yeah.
It's brilliant.
So that was, it was the golden age of doing that, was the mid-60s, changing your name. Although even, later on in the 60s, I still can't get over this. The fact that Reg Dwight from Pinner, who was, this short, slightly plump, slightly absurd-looking character in John Baldry's band, announced, I think when they came back from a tour of Scotland or somewhere like that, they'd gone on some particularly miserable tour in the middle of winter and, had people who just wanted to hear Let the Howtakes Begin, which was John Baldry's hit, at the time, and they all wanted to play, Mose Allison or whatever they wanted to play. So at the point of their lowest defeat, at their very lowest ebb, just before Christmas, in the winter, coming back from a tour, Reg Dwight announces to the rest of the band on the bus from the airport that henceforth he would like to be known as Elton John. I mean... Can you imagine how
the
much
idea being that would happen instantly? Someone would turn around and say, "Hey, Elton, would you like some cupcakes?"
The idea that you did it—you see, the thing about changing your name is you've got to do it when nobody cares what your name is, one way or the other. You know what I mean? So the whole notion of ever being famous is just ridiculous, because nobody knew nor cared whether he was Elton John or Reg Dwight, and to make that announcement that you've made that change, there's something quite sad and profound about it, isn't there?
It is sad. No, you're right, absolutely. and how would they have dealt with that? My god, that would have been impossible, wouldn't it?
Well, they just laughed at him. They just laughed at him, but boy, he got the last laugh.
He did.
In the biggest, because that's the most successful case of anybody changing their name in the history of pop music. Discuss
the word podcast, two cocoa tins and a piece of string.
Can we just applaud and welcome the new patrons?
Certainly.
And they are Rob Kitson, Dave Holly, Tot Taylor.
There's a name.
George A. McCaskill. What a great name that is. Terrific. Mike Hatley and Jacqueline. So well, thanks very much.
Very nice to have them all aboard. And they, of course, will be able to be involved in some of the many things that we're, many special offers that we're extending to Patreon supporters, including we have a number of crowdcasts set up for the next few weeks, which is our efforts to keep the Word in Your Ear events alive, but do them online, which has the advantage that we can also, we can get a wider range of guests because we're not restricted to people just in the UK. And so, you know, one of our guests is, for instance, Kenneth Womack, who's written the book about John Lennon's last year in New York City. We were talking to him from the United States. We've also got Crowdcast featuring, is it Joe Banks, who's written a book about Hawkwind and the Underground.
And the British Underground.
And I'm trying to remember what the third one is that we've announced. Can you remember?
Glam metal.
Yes, of course. Yes, it's a book about glam metal and everything that goes with it. So in those cases, what we're going to do is we'll record those things online via Crowdcast, but Patreon supporters will be able to be in the room, if you like, as we actually
and able to ask questions.
And so there are, you know, there are loads of different things coming your way. If you want to find out more about them, just go to patreon.com/wordinyourear. I've just got to close with this, Mark.
This is so funny. I was sent
by Gary Warren, who sent us this from New York City. He claims he happened upon this recording totally by mistake. I don't know whether I believe it, but basically, it's you and me sounded like the most drunk and the most pompous rock
critics. It's at half speed, isn't it?
It's half speed. So, okay, here we go.
Up till then, the broadsheet
has been kind of
been a bit appalled.
It's like Keith Richards.
I know rock critics who sound like that. You know,
rock critics are the most pompous species of human being on the earth. But yeah, they're talking.
Ron Stewart going out spending ludicrous.
I sound like Prince Charles. It's appalling.
Richly entertaining. Doing Elton John, marvellous. The more absurd you are, the more. I still get kind of mail about it. Listen to me. Why don't you go to Poland with Meridian?
You sound like Mick Jagger. I sound like Keith Richards.
We are Mick and Keith, aren't we?
We are totally from Stella Street.
Fish larger than life, literally and
metaphorically.
And we went to Poland. They say this is in the days before the war.
Oh well, there you go, there you go. So that's how it goes. So Gary Warren, thank you very much
for that.
We'll get you a playtime.
That ended up the lead in the picture was him with his arm round this kind of girl in a rather short skirt.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.